Stories, fables, ghostly tales, the podcast.
What separates a normal citizen from a serial killer? Two people walk through the same street at night. They pass the same houses. They hear the same distant traffic. They live in the same city, under the same laws, raised by the same social rules. One of them feels a flicker of unease and quickens their step. The other feels something else entirely. Not fear, not caution, but curiosity. The difference. The emotional meaning assigned to other human beings is where this episode begins. Because the truth is uncomfortable, serial killers do not begin as monsters. They begin as people who slowly, repeatedly, and deliberately disconnect from the humanity of others. Reputable criminology and psychological literature define serial murder as the unlawful killing of at least two victims by the same offender across separate events separated by time. That separation matters. It means the act was not impulsive, not singular, and not confined to one emotional explosion. It was a choice, made again and again. A normal citizen, by contrast, is not defined by perfection. They get angry, they feel jealousy, they imagine revenge in fleeting thoughts, but most people have internal restraints. Empathy that causes distress when others suffer, remorse that punishes wrongdoing from the inside, emotional bonds that make harm costly, and moral breaks that engage even when nobody is watching. The core distinction is not rage versus calm. It is connection versus detachment. And that detachment shows up in specific, repeatable psychological traits. Trait 1, absence of remorse. When harm does not hurt the one who causes it. Most people experience guilt as a corrective force. They replay conversations. They feel shame in the body. They seek repair. In serial offenders, remorse is often absent, shallow, or performative. Case study: Gary Ridgway. Ridgway murdered dozens of women over many years. In interviews analyzed by Federal Bureau of Investigation's behavioral specialists, Ridgway described his actions with emotional flatness. Victims were discussed as objects, obstacles, or inconveniences. Expressions of regret appeared only when self-interest was involved, such as facing punishment or losing privileges. This is a critical distinction. A normal citizen feels pain because they caused pain. A serial killer feels pain only when consequences arrive. The absence of internal punishment allows repetition. Trait 2. Manipulation as a way of relating, not as last resort. Everyone manipulates occasionally. Social life involves persuasion, but serial offenders use manipulation as a primary relational strategy. They do not ask, they engineer. Case study: Ted Bundy. Bundy's case is heavily documented in Federal Bureau of Investigation historical analysis. He used deception, feigned injury, false authority, emotional vulnerability to bypass consent. His charm was not a personality trait, it was a tool. Bundy did not form relationships, he created access. A normal citizen seeks connection and fears rejection. A serial killer seeks control and studies response patterns. Trait 3, boundary destruction. When no is treated as negotiation. Healthy people experience boundaries as real and inviolable. They may dislike them, but they respect them. Serial offenders experience boundaries as challenges. Case study: Dennis Rader. Rader referred to himself as bind, torture, kill. His crimes were not spontaneous. They were ritualized, violations of autonomy. Letters sent to the police revealed obsession with dominance, compliance, and control. Boundaries did not exist to Rader. They existed to be erased. This trait is not loud. It often appears as persistence, pressure, and entitlement. Trait 4, compartmentalization. the mask that holds. Serial killers often maintain functional public lives. This is not hypocrisy. It is psychological partitioning. Case study, Harold Shipman. Shipman was a trusted physician. He murdered patients over decades. The official Shipman inquiry revealed how he exploited institutional trust and professional authority. His public identity remained intact, while his private actions were lethal. A normal citizen struggles to reconcile moral contradictions. A serial killer separates them cleanly. Trait 5. Entitlement to power over others. This trait appears repeatedly in criminological literature. The belief that another person's body, fear, or life can be claimed. Case study, Aileen Warnos. Warnos's case is complex and controversial. She claims self-defense and her history includes severe trauma. Still, courts and investigators identified repeated killings across separate events. This case demonstrates something critical. Background trauma does not automatically produce serial murder, but entitlement to lethal decision-making does. Normal citizens experience rage and still see a human being. Serial killers experience rage and see justification. Trait 6. Fantasy escalation. When imagined violence needs reality. Many people have intrusive, violent thoughts. Most find them disturbing. Serial offenders often find them comforting. Case study, Jeffrey Dahmer. Dahmer's confessions examined in forensic literature reveal escalating fantasies centered on control and possession. Over time, imagination alone became insufficient. Fantasy required enactment. The key distinction is not imagination itself, but repetition without moral resistance. And trait 7, chronic rule violation without moral weight. Rules exist to protect others. Serial offenders treat rules as obstacles. Case study, John Wayne Gacy. Gacy maintained community involvement and social status while violating laws repeatedly and lethally. His offenses were not driven by ignorance of right and wrong, but by disregard. A normal citizen fears causing harm. A serial killer fears being stopped. When we examine Bundy, Ridgway, Raider, Shipman, Dahmer, and Gracie together, patterns emerge. Victims are dehumanized. Consent is irrelevant. Control is central. Repetition is intentional. Remorse is absent or false. These offenders differ in background, method, and motive, but the psychological architecture overlaps. Serial murder is not just defined by anger, it is defined by permission. Permission to harm without internal consequence. There is a persistent cultural lie that surrounds serial killers. That they are efficient. That they are intelligent. That their lack of empathy gives them clarity. That their manipulation is power. But when you step back and examine real cases, not movies, not myths, but documented lies, these traits are not advantages. They are fatal design flaws, every single one of them. What makes them dangerous in the short term is exactly what destroys them in the long term. Let's walk back through the traits, trait by trait, and witness how each one betrayed the people who relied upon it. Let's look at trait 1, lack of remorse. Empathy and remorse are not weaknesses, they are feedback systems. They tell a person, stop, you are damaging yourself and others. When remorse is absent, behavior does not self-correct, it escalates. How it betrayed Gary Ridgway. Ridgway's lack of remorse allowed him to kill repeatedly, but it also made him careless. Because victims were not real to him, risk was not real either. He returned to familiar dumping grounds. He reused patterns. He spoke too openly once arrested, believing emotional detachment made him smarter than investigators. It didn't. His absence of guilt meant no internal warning system, only external ones, and external systems always catch up eventually. Remorse is painful, but pain prevents repetition. Ridgway had no pain, so he had no breaks. Manipulation, the illusion of control that creates witnesses. Manipulation feels powerful because it creates short-term success, but it is inherently unstable. Every manipulated interaction creates someone who feels off, someone who remembers inconsistencies, and someone who talks. How it betrayed Ted Bundy. Bundy relied on deception as his primary tool, and it worked until it stopped working. and became a problem. Multiple survivors described his tactics. Witnesses noticed his behavior. Police sketches circulated. Patterns emerged. Bundy believed charm made him untouchable. In reality, it made him recognizable. Manipulation does not erase memory, it sharpens it. The very technique Bundy trusted became the thread investigators pulled until everything unraveled. Boundary destruction. The flaw that guarantees escalation. Respecting boundaries limits harm. Destroying boundaries demands escalation. Once no, no longer counts, nothing counts. That forces offenders to go further each time to feel the same sense of dominance. How it betrayed Dennis Rader. Rader could not stop. Not because he was compelled, but because boundary violation does not satisfy permanently. It creates hunger. He wrote letters. He taunted police. He inserted himself back into the narrative. Why? Why would he do this? Because boundary destruction creates exposure pressure. The offender must be seen to feel powerful. That need to be acknowledged is what ultimately led to his arrest. The flaw wasn't cruelty, it was inability to disengage. Let's look at compartmentalization, the fracture that attracts scrutiny. Maintaining two selves requires constant maintenance. Every compartment leaks. How it betrayed Harold Shipman. Shipman relied on compartmentalization. A respected doctor in public, a murderer in private. But the more bodies accumulated, the more paperwork did too. Death certificates, prescription patterns, statistical anomalies. Compartmentalization delayed detection, but also concentrated evidence. Eventually, the pattern could not be hidden inside the mask. Compartmentalization does not erase reality, it stacks it. And stacked reality collapses under its own weight. What about entitlement, the trait that turns rage into evidence? Entitlement convinces the offender that their feelings justify their actions, but entitlement also creates predictability. How it betrayed Eileen Wuornos. Wuornos's sense of entitlement to lethal decision-making, regardless of motive disputes, meant she crossed the same moral line repeatedly. Repetition creates traceable timelines. Geographic patterns, forensic overlap. Entitlement removes restraint, and restraint is what prevents patterns. Once restraint is gone, investigation becomes inevitable. Let's now look at fantasy escalation, the flaw that demands reality. Fantasy is safe only when it stays imaginary. When fantasy becomes a comfort, it seeks embodiment. How did it betray Jeffrey Dahmer? Dahmer's fantasies escalated because imagination stopped satisfying him. Each real-world act intensified the need for the next. It's a kind of addiction. That escalation increased risk, expanded victim pools, multiplied witnesses, and invited interruption. Fantasy-driven violence is not stable. As I mentioned, it is addictive. An addiction always requires more. That need for more is what exposed Dahmer again and again until escape was no longer possible. And our final trait, just for today's episode, is chronic rule violation, the blindness to consequence. Rules exist because they encode consequences over time. Ignoring them does not remove consequences, it just simply delays them. How it betrayed John Wayne Gacy. Gacy believed social status insulated him. He violated legal, moral, and social boundaries repeatedly while assuming proximity to power protected him. Well, it did not. The volume of violations created, suspicious disappearances, repeated complaints, physical evidence accumulation, and rule-breaking without conscience created data density. Eventually, that data density became proof. Across every case, the same truth emerges. These traits do not create freedom, they remove correction. Empathy slows harm, remorse interrupts cycles, boundaries prevents escalation, and connection disperses isolation. When those systems are stripped away, the offender becomes trapped in their own psychology, forced to escalate, repeat, and expose themselves. Serial killers are not powerful because they lack empathy. They are vulnerable because they lack breaks. And that is why every case ends the same way. Now, we're going to go look at how these traits may have formed. in each case study using forensic findings, inquiry evidence, and historical reporting. And we're going to keep it responsible. Development is not destiny. Many people experience neglect, abuse, addiction, humiliation, or trauma and never hurt anyone. The difference is what a person chooses to rehearse, reinforce, and repeat over time. I'll go trait by trait, and for each trait, I'll refer back to each case and show the most evidence-supported pathway we have. And I'll take each of the individual serial killers in a sort of snapshot view for each of those traits to understand how they would potentially develop. And these traits, you know, they're built, not in one moment, not in one trigger, but in a long chain of small permissions, a small lie that worked, a small boundary crossed without consequence, a fantasy rehearsed until it stopped feeling wrong, a mask worn so often it became the face. Ted Bundy, manipulation as operating systems. He repeatedly manufactured safe situations to get compliance, approaching women with feigned injury, casts, slings, crutches, or implied authority, then converting help into access. Now, what could have shaped this? This looks like a person who learned that performance beats truth. Each successful approach is a lesson. I can make strangers override their instincts if I act like the right kind of harmless. Over time, that became a practice skill, not a one-off trick. Boundary violation as entitlement. His approach style wasn't just talking. It was engineering consent out of the moment, then overriding the victim's autonomy once isolated. What could have shaped this? When someone rehearses scenarios where another person's no never fully arrives because the setup prevents it, the brain learns a warped rule. Boundaries are problems to solve, not lines to respect. Compartmentalization, the mask that holds. He maintained normal, functional social presentation while carrying out repeated predation across places and time. So what could have shaped this? Sustained double life behavior often grows from repetition. Every time the mask works, it reinforces the split. It becomes psychologically easier to treat the public self as the real one and the victim-facing self as disposable. What about Dennis Rader? First up is control obsession. He didn't just kill, he staged domination, binding, controlling environments, and turning people into captive objects inside a script. The consistency and ritual feel like long-term rehearsal. The likely influence isn't anger, but an internal reward loop. Control creates emotional payoff, so the behavior becomes increasingly structured. Recognition as hunger. After years, he re-entered the investigation with communications, trying to steer police and prove he still mattered. Then escalated contact until he made an avoidable mistake. This resembles a person who experienced power most intensely when others reacted. If the fantasy is I dominate, then being ignored is psychological starvation, which pushes risk-taking to force acknowledgement. Then there's overconfidence. He literally asked if a floppy disk could be traced, was reassured, then sent one, and it helped lead police to him. Long evasion builds a dangerous belief, I am smarter than the system. That belief isn't a superpower. It's a trap that makes the offenders careless and downright bonkers. Harold Shipman, exploiting trust as access. He used the doctor role as a direct pathway to victims. Home visits, clinical authority, routine presence, and then lethal action could be hidden behind medical normality. So what could have shaped this? The most influential scenario here is structural. When a role grants privacy, unquestioned access, and a built-in explanation for death, an offender can learn that the world will rationalize their harm for them. Reality rewriting. The death of Kathleen Grundy triggered scrutiny, and a forged will became a clear example of I can rewrite the story and take what I want. This kind of act reflects entitlement that grows when small ethical violations succeed. If earlier misconduct is survived, it teaches consequences are negotiable, especially for me. Compartmentalization reinforced by institutional delay. He sustained a long-running hidden pattern before the system fully confronted it, which is itself reinforcement of the mask works belief. When an institution's default posture is trust, the offender gets repeated confirmation that their public identity will protect them, until evidence becomes too dense to ignore. Jeffrey Dahmer, possession drive. His crimes involve not just killing, but acts that reflect ownership and control beyond death, treating bodies as objects to keep, alter, and possess. What could have shaped this? A plausible influence is the substitution of control for relationships. When real connection fails or feels intolerably unstable, control can become the solution a person rehearses until it hardens. Escalation through opportunity and concealment. One of these starkest scenes, Conorak Synthasymphone escaped. Witnesses begged police to intervene and he was returned to Dharma, who then killed him. That kind of event is an accelerant. When an offender experiences "I got him back" through external failure, it teaches an extraordinarily dangerous lesson. Even if something goes wrong, the system may still protect me. Detachment that looks calm. Continued offending despite increasing public risk signals an internal state where the victim's humanity doesn't function as a stopping force. Repetition itself reshapes the conscience. The more often a harm is paired with emotional relief or gratification, the less the brain treats it as a moral urgent. John Wayne Gacy. Coercion by compliance, turning cooperation into captivity. A repeat pattern described in the records, luring young men with work opportunity or social access, then using compliance-based trap like a handcuff trick to flip a normal interaction into restraint. What could have shaped this? This reflects a person who learned to build situations where the victim participates in their own vulnerability, a learned predatory technique that likely sharpened through repetition and success. Social mask exploitation. He sustained a public persona, community involvement, normal social presence, while accumulating victims which made early suspicion easier to dismiss. When reputation prevents accountability, it becomes addictive. Each time concern is waved away. The offender learns, "My image is armor." Escalation until a single disappearance collapses the mask. The disappearance of Robert Piest became the leverage point that pushed police attention onto him and tightened the net. The pattern suggests growing confidence, more frequent offending, more risk, less caution. That's what happens when repeated success convinces someone they're untouchable. Gary Ridgway, targeting the overlooked. He admitted he targeted sex workers because he believed they were less likely to be reported missing and expressed hatred toward them. This is a worldview training itself into permission. Some lives count less. Once someone internalizes that hierarchy, it becomes easier to harm without internal resistance. Repetition as proof of emotional collapse. He confessed to dozens of killings over the years, indicating sustained ability to repeat lethal harm without remorse-based interruption. The reinforcing scenario is grimly practical. If early victims do not trigger swift consequences, the offender experiences success, and success becomes the teacher. Eileen Wuornos. Violence framed as preemptive justification. Her first known victim, Richard Mallory, was shot. She claimed self-defense, with later legal proceedings laying out the scenario details and forensic findings. A plausible influence is a life where threat feels constant. When someone's history is saturated with danger and exploitation, their brain can start reading ambiguity as attack. And that can evolve into, "I must act first," thinking. Pattern continuation despite the rising heat. Multiple victims over a short span suggests a loop where killing becomes a repeated solution to whatever internal state is driving it. Fear, rage, need, resentment, or opportunism. Now, what could have shaped this? Well, once the first act is crossed and survived, the moral barrier is gone. From there, repetition can be fueled by panic, reinforcement, and the growing belief that the world is enemy territory. And have a think to yourself. Do you know anyone that constantly sees the world as a threat, that sees the negatives perhaps, or doesn't take opportunities in the thought that someone will step in their way and stop them? Now, that isn't actually a trait that links them directly to anything like this, but it is a trait that is taken too far in serial killers like Eileen Wuornos. What all of this leaves us with? When you strip away the mythology, the headlines, the shock value, what remains is something quieter and far more important. Every trait we explored was not a superpower, not intelligence, not inevitability. They were failures of connection, failures of restraint, and failures of correction. Manipulation did not make these individuals clever, it made them predictable. Boundary violations did not make them free, it forced escalation. Fantasy did not give them clarity, it hollowed out their reality. Compartmentalization did not protect them, it delayed collapse. And most importantly, none of these traits emerged fully formed. They hardened through repetition. They were rewarded by silence. They were strengthened by getting away with smaller harms first. That is the real dividing line between a normal citizen and a serial killer. Not anger, not trauma, not even dark thoughts. It is whether a person still experiences other human beings as real, real enough to stop themselves. Empathy is not softness, remorse is not weakness, and boundaries are not inconvenience. They are the systems that keep our society intact. And when those systems fail inside a person, the damage doesn't stay private for long. Understanding this isn't about fear, it's about awareness and about recognizing how easily small permissions can grow into catastrophic ones and why catching them early matters. And that is where I'll leave you for now. Before I close out, I want to take a good long moment to acknowledge the people who make this work possible, not just financially, but intellectually, emotionally, and creatively. My pals that support me via my Patreon. If you have any spare dollar dues to help improve this podcast and see it punch up and grow and expand, feel free to visit my Patreon page at www.patreon.com/SFGT, where you will get higher quality audio and 1 week early episodes. And of course, my amazing thank yous. All supporters get a shout out in some shape or form. My way of saying thank you so much for your support. First up is my amazing deity level, god tier, planetary shifting friend of mine, Matto Star, my old Night Tea Titan. Matto, your support deserves more than a line. It deserves space. You don't just back this podcast. You engage with it, you spend time, you listen with intent, and you notice details others miss. And I feel as an investigator, you would ask the kind of questions that would sharpen that kind of work rather than flatten it. You have a keen eye, not just for what's said, but for what is implied. And that kind of attention elevates everything. Thank you for your active, thoughtful, and deeply valued support and friendship. Thank you, Matto, for standing behind this work with curiosity, trust, insight, and friendship. You genuinely shape this podcast moving forward. And a big part of why I've moved over to true crime is because of lovely friends like yourself and all other Patreon supporters. And you are a big part of why I've been doing this for 10 years. The love and support I get from yourself and all Patreon supporters puts a pep in my step like you wouldn't believe. So thank you, Matto, for always being there and being my friend. Have an amazing, amazing week ahead, and I'll be in touch, legend. And now onto my White Tea Warlords.
White Tea Warlords!
Where each one of you legends brings something distinct and unique to this space. Leza, my disciplined, focused, gym-forged friend. There's something powerful about someone who understands consistency and effort. That mindset translates into real support and it shows. And your level of discipline, both in life and in support of this podcast, I can only imagine you would have as what they would call bolder shoulders with that kind of determination. Mate, please do an extra 5 reps just for my silly self. I think you can handle it, right, buddy? So thank you so much, Leza, for being so awesome and being my friend. Thank you again for your support and have an absolutely epic week ahead. And enjoy the gym, legend. And to my next White Tea Warlord, Maya, Queen of Cats, perceptive, calm, observant. You carry that quiet authority that comes from noticing patterns others rush past. There is wisdom in that stillness, Maya. And thank you so much for your friendship and your support. What an absolute stalwart as well. Thank you. Have a fantastic week ahead. You are awesome. And my final White Tea Warlord, Sangeetha the Seer, intuitive, thoughtful, and always a step ahead. You see the shape of things before they fully form, and that perspective adds depth to everything you touch. Thank you, Sangeetha. Thank you for your support and your friendship. Have a brilliant week ahead. And to all of my supporters who support in your own way, thank you for being the foundation that is steady, respectful, and genuinely, I appreciate you. And on that note, I do want to also say thank you to my All Grain Forces now and all tiers thereafter. I am lucky to have Chad Warren, Peter Raffaelli, Just Heather, Juicebox Andy, Paige Kramer, Seductive Smiles, Jane Gumnick, and Michael Krupp. Thank you so much for your support. To all of you, thank you for believing in work that takes its time, asks hard questions, and treats serious subjects with care. And to everyone listening, thank you for staying with me and this difficult conversation and for choosing understanding over sensationalism. You are all wonderful. Have a fantastic week. And as always, till next we meet.
They thought they were powerful. They were just unchecked. Smiles like keys, lies like tools. Every line crossed, rewrote the rules. Control felt clean, felt precise, till patterns formed, paid the price. Manipulation isn't strength, it's dependency. Boundary violation forces visibility. Every trait they trusted turned against them in the end. They didn't lack emotion, they lacked the stop to bend. Most people feel guilt and stop.
Mm-hmm.